Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We generally don't see avian influenza causing problems in these species, but this is an unusual case.
The new strain of bird flu is detected in a fox in the Aleutian Islands. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 27th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a bill awaiting Governor Mike Dunleavy's signature could help seafood processors grow.
Alaska seafood, whether it's salmon or whether it's cod or pollock or any of our seafood, really compete in a global market.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
The new strain of bird flu that arrived in Alaska with the spring migration has now been detected in a fox that died in the Aleutian Islands. Wildlife officials say the red fox, as well as eagles found dead in the Unalaska area, were most likely feeding on birds that died from the H5N1 avian influenza. State veterinarian Dr. Bob Gerlach says that's different from previous strains of bird flu.
We generally don't see avian influenza causing problems in these species, but this is an unusual case. And so between that and the significant number of mortalities in waterfowl, it's a concern and significant.
The H5N1 bird flu has caused the deaths of millions of poultry in the lower 48, as well as wild birds and some foxes there. In early May, Alaska confirmed its first case of the virus. It was found in a non-commercial flock of chickens and ducks in the Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough. But so far, wildlife officials say it has not impacted domestic mammals in Alaska, and this strain and previous strains have not proven to be a significant health concern for humans or domesticated dogs and cats. Those pets could still be susceptible, though, and Gerlach says there are plenty of other reasons to keep pets away from wildlife, especially dead birds.
If there is a dead bird or dead animal there, we don't know what they died from. If it's not influenza that's transferred, it could be either a bacteria or maybe other virus that is possibly transferable. And the most common ones we see are Salmonella and E. coli. And then obviously those can be transferred to people too.
Alaskans harvesting birds or other wildlife for food are urged to use the usual safety precautions, like wearing gloves, thoroughly cooking meat, and not eating animals that appear to have been sick. Anyone who sees a sick bird or one acting strangely, or the carcass of a bird if the cause of its death is not readily apparent, can call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Alaska Sick or Dead Bird Hotline. That number is 1-866-527-3358. Early and absentee in-person voting began today for the U.S. House special primary election. It's the state's first by-mail election, and ballots have already been sent to registered voters. But Alaskans can also vote in person at one of 170 sites. Gail Fanumiai, the director of Alaska Division of Elections, has a couple reminders if you choose to vote in person.
Make sure that you know the hours of operation, and be prepared to show identification when you appear to vote in front of the election official.
Alaskans can check the hours of their local voting locations online at elections.alaska.gov. A ballot will be provided at the voting location. Fanumiai says Alaskans who vote in person should not mail in a ballot.
They can destroy their ballot at home by tearing it and disposing of it. If they have a shredder, they can go ahead and shred it.
Alaskans choosing to vote by mail must have their ballots postmarked by Election Day. That's Saturday, June 11th. Voting officials encourage mailing ballots early, since many rural post offices send mail to Anchorage to be postmarked. And there's a third way to vote. Fanumiai says voters can also drop off their mail-in ballots at the in-person voting locations.
And they have ballot boxes there that they would be able to leave their ballot with the election official, as well as any of our 5 regional offices around the state, people can hand deliver their ballots there as well.
As of Wednesday, the state had received more than 83,000 ballots so far, according to the Division of Elections. A bill awaiting Governor Mike Dunleavy's signature has some Alaska seafood processors thinking of expansion. As KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, that includes some shoreside facilities on Kodiak Island.
Senate Bill 33 extends tax credits through the year 2026 for salmon and herring processors in Alaska that invest in new equipment. The bill was sent to the governor on May 2nd, and if it's signed into law, shoreside facilities that process Pacific cod and pollock would also be eligible for the program. Chris Barrows is the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. He says that could give the state's seafood industry an economic boost.
The volume of fisheries is not likely to change over time, but so what we can do in terms of the economics is all about trying to increase the value. So that's expanding that to cod and pollock is a good way to be able to bring those higher value products for that return on investment.
Processors in Kodiak are already planning ahead. Mark Palmer is the chief executive for OBI Seafoods, which has nearly a dozen facilities in Alaska, including Kodiak. He said via email that the company intends to invest in its Kodiak facility, where the majority of its ground fish, like Pacific cod and pollock, is processed. OBI may use the tax credit for equipment to start producing surimi, a paste made from whitefish that mimics other seafood products, according to Palmer. And he says it's good timing, as many countries are looking for alternatives to whitefish products exported from Russia. Barrow says he can't speak for other companies' plans, but there's collective excitement that Alaska seafood will ultimately end up on more far-flung shelves in some shape or form.
Alaskans and our policymakers really understand that Alaska seafood, whether it's salmon or whether it's cod or pollock or any of our seafood, really competes in a global market.
Kodiak Republican State Senator Gary Stevens sponsored the bill, and Kodiak Republican House Speaker Louise Stutes introduced companion legislation. It's currently awaiting a signature from Governor Dunleavy. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaskans will soon be able to reach a suicide prevention hotline by calling a 3-digit number instead of a 10-digit number. Starting July 16th, calls to 988 will go to the CARE line, Alaska's suicide hotline. It's part of a national effort to establish one suicide hotline number across the country. At a public health presentation on Wednesday, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ann Zink said it will provide an alternative to 911 for people experiencing mental health emergencies.
It can be for people who are in crisis or someone who is caring for someone in crisis. And essentially what we'll do is we'll connect you to the CARE line.
Zink also thanked communities like Fairbanks, where 911 and 988 teams are working together to coordinate responses to mental health emergencies.
911 and 988 are working together and sometimes can even dispatch mental health providers in lieu of police or EMS to be able to respond to mental health crises, not just physical crises.
Until 988 is active on July 16th to reach the CARE line, Alaskans can use 877-266-HELP. The number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, high school students travel by helicopter to study a nearby glacier.
You can just really see the whole entire glacier and the bay. It's like a bird's eye view of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents, did you know that 1 out of 4 Alaska high school students currently use e-cigarettes? E-cigarettes are easy to use and easy to hide. What teens breathe in and out from e-cigarettes is not safe. It contains cancer-causing chemicals, toxic metals, and nicotine. Nicotine can lead to addiction. It can harm brain development and hurt memory, learning, and attention span. Parents, talk to your teens about vaping. Visit livevapefree at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quitline.
For many, Memorial Day weekend means picnics and the beginning of serious summer weather. In Sitka, however, it's the beginning of serious sport fishing with the kickoff of the 67th annual Sitka Salmon Derby. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
This is actually the 66th go-round for the Sitka Salmon Derby, which began in 1956, but like just about everything, was forced to take a break during the 2020 pandemic. Derby Chairman John McCrahan is expecting things to be back to normal this year.
I'm doing good. The barge is almost ready to go. I hook up the water line, and I think I'll be ready for business, selling tickets.
Those tickets are $5 more than last year to cover some higher costs. That's about the only change in the event, which will otherwise have the usual boundaries from roughly Salisbury Sound in the north to Crawfish Inlet in the south. As in the past, way stations will be moored in Killeenan Bay and in Goddard Bay. The Derby runs the 3 days of Memorial Day weekend, May 28th, 29th, and 30th, and the 2 days of the following weekend, June 4th and 5th, for a total of 5 days of fishing. The split format of the Derby always creates a bit of tension, since the leading fish as of 7 p.m. on Memorial Day could be unseated the following weekend. That's what happened last year when Patrick Davis's 35-pound 8-ounce king was knocked out of the lead by Charlie Skultka Sr.'s 36-pound 8-ounce fish, which went on to claim the $5,000 prize. McCrahan is happy to see the kings coming in a bit larger again after a couple of low years in 2018 and 2019.
We're getting going in the right direction. He was 36.8. Year before was 31.2. So we're hoping to see some big ones this year. Talked to a couple people that are out there, and one guy had a 30-pound, so we know they're there.
The biggest fish of the 2021 Derby was landed by someone who wasn't a Derby contestant. Gary Oinas, a local charter captain, stopped by the Derby barge in Crescent Harbor last year just to have a fish weighed. It came in at 48 pounds. It would have been the clear winner in both the daily weight and overall weight categories and worth $6,000. But Oinas didn't have a ticket, and you can't buy one retroactively. I'm sure he'll buy one this year, said McCrahan. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Housing in Kodiak can be difficult to find at any price, and that's a big problem for employers. As KMXD's Dylan Samard reports, Kodiak's hospital is trying something new, building its own apartment complex.
Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center Administrator Carl Hertz says lately it's been hard to attract new employees to the island. Last year, he says, 9 new hires withdrew after they were unable to find somewhere to live. Hertz says he had trouble himself when he first came to Kodiak.
When I moved in January a couple years ago, I had a real challenge finding a home for my family and I. And in fact, it took me all of 6 months before I could locate one. And I firsthand learned the anxiety when you think you're going to lose your place to live. And so I wanted to work with Providence to make it easier for folks to move onto the island.
So last year, Hertz decided to tackle the problem head on. That led to the groundbreaking of the $5.1 million housing structure this month. The 16 one- and two-bedroom apartments are intended to serve as short-term housing for doctors and nurses while they look for more permanent options. Hertz says the units look more like hotel rooms than traditional apartments.
I'm imagining the average length of stay for our caregivers will be right around the six-month mark, depending on how fast they can find other housing. These aren't giant apartments, so they're not designed for caregivers to stay in for years, but it will be a nice, clean, safe space for them to be while they search.
Hertz says housing is a problem for hospitals around the country, and he thinks that this housing model could be just the solution they need. While Providence does have caregiver housing in locations around the country, it has never operated as the landlord in any of them.
I think this is a beta test for Providence, and if it works, I could see Providence as well as other health systems following suit. Hospital workers are fleeing high housing costs all across the country. And so hospital systems, individual hospitals, are going to have to figure out a way to provide workforce housing if they want to have a workforce.
Construction is expected to be completed in August of next year, with new residents moving in a month later. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Samard.
This June marks the 40th anniversary of Celebration, a biennial four-day event based in Juneau celebrating Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian culture. In preparation for this year's festivities, young tribal citizens in Sitka took part in an afternoon regalia workshop, crafting their very own robes, vests, and headbands. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports.
Okay, so these need to be ironed. And then pick your felt.
It's a sunny Saturday morning in Sitka, a coveted occurrence in the otherwise rainy Southeast community. In the basement of Blatchley Middle School, a small group of Sitka students is busy measuring, cutting, and sewing. For these kids, today is about honoring their culture through the age-old tradition of regalia making, even if that means missing out on the sunshine.
We're not making you work away on a Saturday. We're here celebrating our culture, and we're very excited to help you guys and teach you how to do that.
That's Claire Hill. She's one of a handful of parents and cultural educators who put together the workshop in preparation for Juno's upcoming celebration.
The different types of regalia we're going to be focusing on today will have vests. Those are usually used not really for dancing so much or performing, but they're used really as an expression of who you are. Robes are really used mostly for performances, and it's a reflection more of who your family is. A little bit of who you are as an individual, but you're representing your family, and that's going to be visually expressed on your robe.
While attendees will walk away with their own vest, robe, or headband, Hill says the workshop is about more than just the tangible pieces of regalia.
The person that's wearing the regalia, it's really for them to showcase who they are, the family they come from, the people that they are from. Regalia is something that we must respect. It's a part of our history. It has symbols of our different clans. So it's something that's very honored and it's very respected.
As someone who came to regalia making later in life, Hill has made a point to include it in the upbringing of her own child.
I want it to just be what he knows. It's his normal to be very proud to wear his regalia. And I think that's really important as far as establishing self-confidence. It's very important for me and a lot of other parents that I talk to.
Kids mill around the classroom, eagerly taking measurements, cutting fabric, and picking out the form line drawings they'll use in their creations. For middle schooler Jason Miller, this was his first time making a robe.
I'm Yanyedi. My Tlingit name is Geshua. I'm going to have a red wolf design and then a red border. The main color is going to be blue.
Do you want to show her your design?
Yeah, my design's over there. No. So, gonna be a wall.
Oh wow! Did you make that?
No, I just found it over there.
Okay. The group will meet once more to finish their pieces, and later this summer they'll proudly display them at Celebration, where, with any luck, the sun will be shining. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
A small group of Petersburg High School students spent Monday night calculating the latest position of the terminus of the southernmost tidewater glacier in the Northern Hemisphere. They're part of a decades-long tradition to survey the LeConte Glacier. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
Kinley, 0.9, south side, 65, 26.
High school math teacher Tom Thompson assigns data points to the sophomores, juniors, and seniors gathered to eat pizza and crunch the numbers. Just days before, they spent their day recording those points using survey equipment, helicoptered up to spots high up on either side of the steep-walled fjord. Senior Latham Johnson uses a software design program called Rhino to map out the survey points.
And then it kind of shows how far, if the glacier is receding or if it's increased since the last time. And I guess it's been really stable over the last few years, which is awesome. It's a lot better than what was happening before, but yeah.
Johnson had a scheduling conflict and was disappointed not to be able to travel to the glacier this year, but he recommends the experience.
The glacier trip, taking a helicopter up and being able to look at LeConte Glacier is definitely one of the highlights of high school.
The students give up their lunch times Wednesdays throughout the year to learn how to use the surveying equipment and the trigonometry they'll need. Junior Didi Toyamura looks down at a complex drawing of the angles that she's recorded.
So we take angles from the south side to a specific point on the glacier. And then we fly over to the north side and try to find the same point on that side and then take the angle measure of that point.
Part of the challenge is making sure one group on the north side of the fjord and another on the south side are taking a sight on the same spot on the ice face thousands of feet away. Sometimes that point they've just recorded breaks off from the glacier and disappears. That only happened with one this year, and the students seem pretty happy with the data they collected. On the desk nearby, there are printouts from previous year's mapping and photos of the teams of prior students who've been in the program. It was started in 1983 by Petersburg High teacher Paul Bowen, and it's happened almost every year since then, carried on by other instructors like Victor Troutman and now Thompson.
It's such a big glacier when you're looking at it from our perspective. It's really hard to see the recession and precession until you really plot the data, because it looks kind of the same, and then you might realize that it's moved 500 feet or 1,000 feet either way.
Prior students have documented some big retreats of the ice sheet, but it now hits tidewater in a relatively narrower and shallower part of the fjord. Its position has been somewhat stable in recent years. Another senior, Rose Quitzlin, helped with calculations last year but didn't make the trip to survey the ice until this year. She says it's a much different perspective than her past experiences.
It's spectacular. I've gone out to the glacier so many times since I was a little kid, just going out on the boat with my dad. And it's such a different experience getting helicoptered out there, because the elevation that we're at, it's about 1,200 feet, I think. And so you can just really see the whole entire glacier and the bay. It's like a bird's eye view of it.
The survey captures the ice sheet's position at just one point in time. It's dynamic and can change dramatically from day to day. But they try to do the survey around the same time every year to make a good comparison. This year's data shows the terminus advanced compared to last year, and it's also further out in the fjord from positions mapped in 2019 and 2018. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Students at Thunder Mountain High School in Juneau celebrated their favorite books through cake this week. It was part of an end-of-the-year project for their AP literature class. But as KTOO's Bridget Dowd reports, to at least one student, the celebration was about more than a letter in the gradebook.
From cake pop pig heads to edible dinosaur cakes, the Thunder Mountain Library was sweeter than usual on Tuesday. Long wooden tables were covered in colorful baked goods and pieces of paper giving context for each one. Thunder Mountain senior Abigail Sparks was standing with her friends admiring her creation, a chocolate cake shaped like a T-Rex with a little something extra.
I've always been obsessed with Jurassic Park, both the movies and the books and just the overall science behind it. I ended up making a peach mango jello bowl thing with a mosquito in it to represent the amber, which is where all the stuff in Jurassic Park really just comes from.
Sparks will be attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the fall to study geology and paleontology. Sparks hopes to eventually work with fossils at a museum or do field research like excavating and dig work. Sparks says she wouldn't call herself a baker, but she does love watching the Great British Bake Off.
I will say I did make the modeling chocolate from scratch, which was difficult, but the fondant and like the frosting and stuff was just me mixing dyes together and calling it a day. I can cook, but I can't bake.
It took her about 10 hours spread out over several days to complete the project. Her cake was one of many created for a final project in Corrine Marx's AP Literature class.
It's all seniors, and it's their last semester, so, you know, let's have a little fun and celebrate with cake.
Marx asked her students to choose a novel they read in high school and represent a scene, theme, or symbol from the book with cake. She calls it the Great Literature Bake-Off. After judging was complete, the class ate their projects. For Sparks and the other students in her class, more than half of their high school career has been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
It's been an odd experience because I I guess I expected more from my high school career, but it's nice to have like a semi-normal senior year to be able to just put everything to a close and move on to the next chapter.
Graduation for Thunder Mountain students will be held on Sunday, May 29th at 7 p.m. The Juno Douglas High School Yadat Atkle graduation will be on the same day at 4 p.m. In Juno, I'm Bridget Dowd.
A Fairbanks photographer has been named the Rasmussen Distinguished Artist of the Year. James Barker is best known as an ethnographic photographer, embedding himself in a community or family to reveal their humanity. KUAC's Robin reports.
The annual statewide honor is a tradition of the Rasmussen Foundation and was reserved for mature artists with an extensive body of creative work. That certainly describes Jim Barker, whose photographs have been shown around Alaska for decades.
He almost never used telephoto lenses because he said when he photographed people, he wanted to be what he called present in their world.
Painter Kessler Woodward of Fairbanks is also a Rasmussen Distinguished Artist. He spoke of Barker's influential work in Bethel, pictures of everyday life in the village.
What I remember best is his telling me that what he hoped to capture was his respect, his wonder at the strength and ingenuity of the people he had come to know in that community.
Jim Barker and his wife Robin were interviewed for the presentation, and he explained why they produced a book from those Bethel photographs called Always Getting Ready, Yupik Subsistence in Southwest Alaska.
I was interviewing a friend, and she said, you know, we are always getting ready. We're always getting ready to go fishing, getting ready to go hunting. You know, it was just a constant preparation for whatever was going to come. Always getting ready.
Now, Barker is non-Native, and his body of work was kind of a watershed event in the depiction of Native Alaskans by non-Native artists. Barker is the first photographer to be a Rasmussen Distinguished Artist.
This has been a considerable surprise to me, to us. Generally, I've been kind of a quiet worker, carefully studying the accuracy and effects of the photographs that I take and the books that I've made. I'm not used to having the Clegg lights on me. I'm used to turning the lights on others.
In the award presentation, the foundation also featured its pictures of civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, migrant farm workers in his home state of Washington, a family living on welfare in Marin County, California, Antarctic scientists maneuvering equipment on sea ice, and family and friends in Fairbanks laughing over the dinner table. The award comes with a $40,000 prize. Rasmussen Foundation CEO Diane Kaplan said, having an arts and culture spirit, vision, and life in Alaska is critical to being a great state.
Not everyone's an athlete. Not every kid is a mathematician. A lot of people find their voice and their future through the arts. The Distinguished Artist Award is a moment of intentionality to focus on the arts in Alaska and the individuals who have spent their life contributing to it.
Nominations for the 2023 Distinguished Artist open October 1st. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Kirsten Dobroth and Dylan Samard and Kodiak, Robert Woolsey and Tosh Kimmel and Sitka, Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Bridget Dowd in Juneau, and Robin in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.